I'm Jim Patterson. I teach Christian Studies here at Union. I'm in my eighth year at Union. I'm in my 30th year of teaching in higher education. My specialty is the field of church history. I did my doctoral work at Princeton Seminary in church history, and that involves some of the classes that I teach here at Union. We are looking this morning at, the topic is Marcion Second Century Roots of Rejecting the Old Testament. Before we get into Marcion specifically, let me tell you a couple background things about second century Christianity. Of course, we believe that the New Testament was completed before the second century, at least I believe that. I don't think there's any book that could be dated any later than maybe AD 95. By the time we get into the second century, basically the apostles have died. Many of them, in fact, died violent deaths. They died in persecution settings, with the possible exception of John. And so with the death of the apostles, I'm fine. With the exception of the... what was I just saying? The last time they asked me, I got started and they wanted to know if I had enough chalk. Well, I had plenty of chalk. There's a new generation then that's going to appear in early Christianity. Very soon after the period of the New Testament, you have a set of writings that usually is under the title of the Apostolic Fathers. These Apostolic Fathers were not actually apostolic. They may have been trained by some of the apostles, but they're the next generation. They're really the post-apostolic fathers. And there's some materials from about 95 to about 155 that kind of reflect some of the things going on in the church at that time. None of those apostolic fathers material, none of that actually alludes to Marcion. Then after that, you get into what are called the early church fathers. The church fathers are more interested in theology and unfolding the meaning of some of the important principles of the Christian faith. And some of these writers also write apologetics, because what also characterizes second century Christianity is a period of persecution. It was not a heavy, intense persecution all the time during the second century. It would flare up here and there in various places in the empire. But there were charges and attacks upon Christianity, and so the apologetic writers, many of whom were also church fathers, would attempt to answer some of those charges. And, of course, what it also indicates is that there were more converts among the educated classes during the second century. In other words, there were people who came to the faith who were equipped to be able to write. And as they deepened in their awareness of the faith, then they were able to answer some of the charges that pagan writers were leveling against the Christian church. The other reality of the second century was the threat of heresy. Now, heresy was not brand new in the second century. You can tell from some of the New Testament writings that there were heretics during the time of the apostles. Paul and John, for example, make references to false teachers, those that we suspect were probably distorting the gospel at a fairly early stage. In fact, some of the other general epistles also allude to false teachers. Letters, for example, like the letter of Jude. So heresy was not kind of a new kid on the block in the second century, but there were different types of heresies than you find within the first century. And, of course, one of these was Marcionism. We're going to be looking at that, obviously, in more detail. There were others like Gnosticism. Now, there are some who think that Gnosticism was actually around when the apostles were writing, because you do have some references in the biblical literature to, say, false knowledge. You know, that may perhaps be some allusion to the Gnostic heresy, or at least a very early version of it. But we don't actually have any source materials from the Gnostics until the second century. they found a lot of text in Egypt after World War II, kind of buried in the sand, and it turned out to be a Gnostic library. If you're familiar with the Da Vinci Code, either the movie or the book, there are some references to materials that are really of a Gnostic background. And maybe in some of the popular media, you've heard references to the Gospel of Thomas, for example. That's a Gnostic gospel. It was not written by the Apostle Thomas. And in fact, it has some unusual things in it. Like at the very end, it says, you have to become a male to enter the kingdom. Now, it's not a very woman-friendly book. I noticed we don't have any women in this session. So maybe they knew I was going to bring that up. But Gnosticism was rooted in this idea of a special kind of knowledge. In fact, the word is rooted in the Greek term gnosis, which means knowledge. And the Gnostics believed that they had a special secret knowledge that was given to them and them only. And basically they felt that man's problem was ignorance, not sin. And how do you overcome ignorance? You overcome it with knowledge. So the Gnostics were out there. There are some who feel that Marcion may have been a Gnostic, although that has been challenged, because even though Marcion shared some of their ideas, there were some other areas where he disagreed with them. So it may not be absolutely precise to say that Marcion was a Gnostic. Another heresy that came roughly around the middle of the second century was Montanism. Very different from Gnosticism. The Montanists could perhaps be described as an early charismatic movement, not emphasizing the speaking in tongues so much, but prophecy, particularly an ecstatic form of prophecy that was delivered where the prophet appeared almost to be in a trance as he uttered words that he claims came from the Holy Spirit. What got the Montanists in trouble is several of their prophecies did not come true, including one where they said that the kingdom was going to come down very soon in Asia Minor, actually in a village where they happened to live. Asia Minor, of course, is Turkey today in the modern world. Well, the kingdom didn't come soon. It didn't come to Asia Minor, and eventually the Montanist movement was discredited. But what I'm trying to picture here is that the second century church faced these challenges, you know, some from pagans in the form of persecution, some from within their own ranks, where you have those who identify themselves as Christians and yet they are actually teaching heresy. So that brings us to Marcion. I've suggested his dates here. You may wonder, what's this discrepancy? Well, some sources place him as being born closer to 85 and others to 110. It may not mean a whole lot. Well, probably did to him. He would have had, 25 more years of life, depending on if he was born here. Virtually all sources agree he died around 160. When we talk about the ancient world, it's common to put a small c in front of a date with a period. That simply means approximately or around those dates. So, you know, we don't have birth certificates for people in the ancient world to be able to pin it down any better. Well, where did he come from? He actually came from Asia Minor, what we call today Turkey, from a section that wasn't too far from the Black Sea. In fact, there was a region in Asia Minor called Pontus. Asia Minor was divided into areas, like Galatia. Galatia was not a city, it was an area. Pontus was an area. And within Pontus, he grew up in the town of Sinope. In fact, from what we can tell about his life, and we don't have nearly as many details as we might like, but his father was a bishop in Sinope, which probably means, if this is the late first century, or even the very early second century, it probably means that he was the pastor of a local church in Sinope, because the idea of a bishop being over many churches didn't come along quite this early. probably you get somewhere around 110, 120 in there, and you have a writer who distinguishes between bishops and elders. But in the New Testament, and even in some non-New Testament works like Clement of Rome, there is no real distinction between the bishop and the elder. And it appears that they functioned as kind of the head pastors of their churches. So his father was a bishop, and it's interesting, one of the later church fathers, a couple centuries later, makes the claim that Marcion's father excommunicated Marcion because he had seduced a consecrated virgin. In other words, that he had committed a sexual sin. Well, this doesn't exactly fit in with Marcion's known lifestyle, because he basically practiced celibacy. And so some have questioned whether this is really accurate. Some think that maybe this later church father was simply trying to smear Marcion, or an alternative explanation is to suggest that that this is actually an allegory, that what the church father was really saying is that the virgin was a metaphor for the church, the kind of young bride of Christ, and that Marcion had seduced the young bride of Christ by heresy, by false teaching. So that may be one way of explaining what that later reference was all about. Well, Marcion was actually a very wealthy man. He earned his money as a ship owner and merchant, and apparently did quite well. He was quite prosperous. And eventually, he traveled to Rome, arriving there somewhere between probably about 135 and 140. And of course, there was a church in Rome, and he, since he had been identified with the church back in Asia Minor, it's not surprising he sought out the church. And in fact, he wanted to give this church a sizable gift. If we were to kind of set the equivalent in our monetary unit, it was probably in the range of around $7,000. Now, that could buy a lot more in the middle of the second century than it could buy today. I mean, today I'm not even sure that's enough for a down payment on most houses, but it was considered a sizable gift. And the church, unfortunately, had heard some disturbing rumors about Marcion's belief. And there is evidence that a kind of council or meeting was held to sort of investigate this. And when that was over, they concluded that indeed Marcion was a heretic. And so they ended up turning back the gift. They did not accept the gift. And in fact, there is evidence that he was excommunicated by the church in Rome around 144 because he was viewed to be a heretic, that is, someone who held false beliefs. During his time in Rome, he apparently met a bishop from Asia Minor by the name of Polycarp, who was visiting Rome at the time. Later, Polycarp was actually a martyr. There's a famous story about him he was burned, and the account suggests that the fire didn't actually kill him, and they had to stab him in order to kill him. But he was 86 years old when he was martyred, and he refused to renounce his faith. He refused to engage in emperor worship, so they killed him. But before this point, he apparently met Marcion, was introduced to Marcion, and one of the accounts suggests that when he met Marcion, he called him the firstborn of Satan. Now, Polycarp has been linked to the Apostle John. There's the possibility that Polycarp had actually studied under John earlier in his life. And he, you know, based on the teachings that he had received, he felt that what Marcion taught didn't jibe with what John taught. So he gives him a rather negative title. Well, when it became clear that Marcion was not going to be accepted in the church in Rome, he decided he was going to have to start his own church, his own movement. and he went about traveling many places in the Mediterranean. There is evidence of him as, I guess we would call him, a church planter of sorts, the wrong kind of churches, I'm afraid. There is evidence that his movement became quite sizable. Well, when I taught this at 8:30, somebody asked me, you know, how large it was. Well, unfortunately, we don't have statistics. We don't really have a reliable record. A lot of the church fathers indicate that he had a lot of followers. Now, I don't know if they were exaggerating that to sort of point out the danger or simply going by what they were aware of in some of the cities of the empire. And the evidence suggests that this movement lasted into the 5th century, into the 400s. One of the church fathers, one of the more colorful church fathers, who was also an apologist, his name was Tertullian. And he lived in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries. He was very sarcastic at times when he wrote, particularly when he wrote about heretics. And he makes a reference in one of his works that Marcion planted churches as wasps make nests. In other words, you have this image, you know, of a lot of activity, and the Marcionites are out there buzzing around, you know, trying to build churches. But again, we just don't have any reliable numbers that we can suggest about how large the movement was. And then he dies around 160. There's some discrepancies about whether he had repented at the end of his life. A couple of the fathers suggest that he might have, but that seems a little shaky. We don't really have firm evidence to that effect. Well, what did Marcion believe? What made him end up being classified as a heretic? It's kind of interesting that, you know, you have Marcionism there in the 2nd century. There is another very opposite heresy that was held by those called the Ebionites. The Ebionites were very strict in their wanting to preserve Judaism and preserving Jewish practices. You know, we know in the 1st century that Paul had some problems with Judaizers, those who identify with the church, but who insisted that Gentiles have to be circumcised and that sort of thing. Of course, Paul stood against that. And the letter to the Galatians is a warning against the Judaizers. Well, the Ebionites, in a sense, could not relinquish some of their Jewish traditions, even if they seemed to be incompatible with the gospel. The Marcionites were just the opposite. They wanted to get rid of anything that smacked of Judaism. They were an anti-Judaistic kind of movement. And in fact, Marcion felt that there should be full separation between Christianity and Judaism. One was the Old Covenant, the other was the New Covenant, and there really wasn't any linkage, according to him. In other words, he just didn't see Jewish roots in the gospel. Some have suggested that what you have with Marcion is kind of an extreme version of Paul's doctrine of grace. But what Marcion ends up doing is setting up a real strong dichotomy between law and grace. You know, law is the Old Covenant, grace is the New Covenant. There was a time when the Chicago Cubs had a first baseman named Grace and a third baseman named Law. Kind of interesting, in the same infield. But if Marcion was, I guess, there, he would make sure that, you know, there was never any connection between first and third base. So for him, the gospel could not be put in what he regarded as the old wineskins of Judaism. So the Ebionites obviously embraced their Judaism and tried to blend it with their understanding of Christianity. Marcion just wants to chuck everything coming out of the Old Testament background. To pursue this a little further, I have found a convenient summary of Marcion's beliefs in a book by Everett Ferguson, who Well, he's both a New Testament scholar and an early church historian, and I'm teaching a night class at the master's level this semester on Thursday nights, and I'm using an introduction to church history that he wrote. It's a volume one of a set that Zondervan has put out. Actually, volume two isn't ready yet, unfortunately. But Ferguson suggests that there were eight basic teachings of Marcion that kind of created some real problems in the early church. Number one, he actually believed that there were two gods. There was the creator God of the Old Testament and the redeemer God of the New Testament. And they were different. The creator God of the Old Testament, he referred to as the demiurge. Which is interesting because some of the Gnostics use that very same term for this creator God. Jehovah was this creator God. And this God was actually evil. Evil and contradictory. Marcion described this demiurge as fickle, ignorant, despotic, crude, cruel, and vengeful. And we know about this from references in the Fathers to a work of Marcion that has not survived. Actually, none of Marcion's writings survived. We only know about them from quotations and summaries in the writings of the Church Fathers. But he had apparently written something called Antitheses. And especially in that document, he portrays this Old Testament God in very negative terms. It's interesting, we bring Tertullian in again here, who loved to use sarcasm, and he muses about how Marcion sets the Old Testament God at variance with the New Testament God. And Tertullian actually had a work called Against Marcion. And in one little section he says, "Listen, you sinners, and you who have not yet come to this, hear that you may attain to sinfulness. A better God has been discovered." He's talking here about Marcion's New Testament God. "A better God has been discovered, one who never takes offense, is never angry, never inflicts punishment, who has prepared no fire in hell, no gnashing of teeth in the outer darkness. He is purely and simply good." Kind of relates a little bit to some things Dr. House was saying at the end of the session this morning, that there are those who don't really want to deal with the reality of God as judge. Well, Marcion didn't want to do that. So the God of judgment is in the Old Testament. The God of in the New Testament is not a judge. Second characteristic of his teaching was that the demiurge was tied up, we've already said, with judgment, but also with law. Law and judgment are part of the Old Covenant, not the New Covenant. And in this discussion, you find references to the demiurge, to the New Testament God as the, quote, strange God. Why did Marcion call the New Testament God the strange God? Well, he says this God was unknown to the world until he came to save people from the vengeful God of the Jews. People didn't know about this New Testament God during the time of the Old Covenant. He had not revealed himself, according to Marcion. Third principle of Marcion that obviously raised a lot of questions is that in the Old Testament revelation, which is the revelation of the Creator God, the Demiurge, there are predictions of the Jewish Messiah. What Marcion says is that this Jewish Messiah is not Jesus. In other words, for Marcion, the Old Testament did not predict the coming of Jesus. The Jewish Messiah, in fact, had not yet come, according to Marcion. So He does not give any credibility to Old Testament prophecy relating to the life, ministry, death, resurrection, etc. of Jesus. And in fact, what Marcion said was that Jesus came not to fulfill, but to destroy what was in the Old Testament, which is, of course, the very opposite of what Jesus says in the Gospel of Matthew. So again, what these points are suggesting is a very sharp dichotomy between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. The fourth point in Marcion's teaching would be how he understood Jesus. Because for Marcion, Jesus was not a real man. You know, Orthodox Christianity affirms that Jesus is fully God and fully man. Marcion denied that Jesus was fully man. In fact, his understanding is often summarized with a term that comes out of the Greek language. It's referred to as a docetic view of Jesus. It comes from a Greek verb that means to appear. For Marcion, Jesus only appeared to be a man. He had some outward signs or characteristics of a man, but he wasn't really a man. He was more like a phantom. He did not have flesh and blood like we have. The Gnostics also believed that about Jesus. The Gnostics were docetic. And in fact, in New Testament times, there were apparently docetics floating around, because in John's first letter, one of the tests when you were examining the spirits was to ask, did Jesus come in the flesh? Because the docetics denied that. And certainly Marcion denies that. Also, an implication of this is that Jesus only appeared to suffer. He didn't really suffer, because he didn't have a body and flesh and blood like we have. Now, this created certain issues regarding the physical birth of Jesus. If Jesus was not really a man, then how could he be born? And one of the interesting things is that Marcion liked the Gospel of Luke. That's the only gospel he accepted, actually. But he did not accept the first two chapters of Luke, because those are the chapters where Jesus is born and where, you know, his childhood. So Marcion chooses to have the Gospel of Luke begin with Jesus in Capernaum in Galilee, kind of the beginning of his public ministry. And he changes the picture there a bit. He says that in the 15th year of Tiberius, Jesus, quote, came down from heaven to Capernaum. So there was no birth. Kind of an odd picture, I guess. Kind of hard to have Christmas, wouldn't it be, if you eliminate those chapters in Luke? And then in the terms of the resurrection, Jesus was resurrected only in soul and spirit. There was no bodily resurrection, because Jesus didn't really have a body. So, again, a rather unusual approach to the person and work of Christ. And also, as part of this docetic thing, he argued that Jesus would not return to judge the living and the dead. Judgment does not belong to the God of the New Testament. That's only the God of the Old Testament. So we can't look for Jesus to come as a judge at the end of time. A fifth element of Marcion's worldview was that the only true apostle was Paul. The others were false apostles. The others, and this would include John and Peter and Andrew and Thomas and all the others, they had, quote unquote, Judaized the gospel. There were too many Jewish elements there. They had interpreted the words and the deeds and the death of Jesus through Jewish lenses. So what Marcion said is that Jesus had to start everything anew with Paul. That Jesus then had passed on to Paul the, quote-unquote real truth of the gospel that the other disciples had messed up, according to Marcion. Now, one of the problems that comes up is that even in Paul, you have statements that Marcion would not accept, according to a lot of these views of his. So in order to get around that, what he suggests is that in Paul's letters, you have later additions that were put there by other people after Paul died. And, of course, there is no real foundation for that, but it helps Marcion deal with some inconsistencies in his own thought. In other words, he doesn't really fully embrace Paul. He argues that, well, the stuff I don't like in Paul wasn't really put there by Paul. Kind of convenient. Well, the sixth element of Marcion's teaching was that he is probably the first figure in the history of the church that we know to try to define the New Testament canon in terms of what belonged in it. You know, we have a 27-book New Testament canon. That was not fully in place overnight. I mean, the books were there in the first century. But in terms of the church confirming and recognizing that indeed these were inspired scripture, that took a while to sort all that out. So in that whole process, Marcion is the first one to show up and say, okay, this is the New Testament. And for him, the New Testament was 10 of Paul's letters. He left out the pastoral epistles. He left out 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, the other letters of Paul, and parts of Luke's gospel. And that was his New Testament canon. You know, you've probably heard of Reader's Digest condensed books. Well, he had a Reader's Digest condensed New Testament, extremely abbreviated form. It's interesting, there's a second century church father by the name of Irenaeus. Late 2nd century, he was bishop in southern France, in a place called Lyon, where, in fact, there had been a fairly intense persecution in the year 177. Irenaeus wrote a very long work called Against Heresies. And if you want a picture of some of the heresies in the 2nd century, Irenaeus would be a good source. I mean, he goes through a bunch of them, including a lot of the Gnostic heresies. But he also addresses the issues raised by Marcion, and he, in fact, summarizes Marcion's canon. And he puts it this way. He says, Marcion mutilates the gospel, which is according to Luke. He removes all that is written respecting the generation of the Lord, and he sets aside a great deal of the teaching of the Lord's discourses, in which the Lord is recorded as most clearly confessing that the maker of this universe is his father. In other words, Marcion has these preconceived ideas about God, and then he uses them to decide what parts of Luke's gospel he can accept and what part he writes out. In like manner, Irenaeus says, Marcion dismembered the epistles of Paul, removing all that is said by the apostle respecting the God who made the world, to the effect that he is the father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and also those passages from the prophetical writings which the apostle quotes in order to teach us that they announced beforehand the coming of the Lord. So what he doesn't like in Paul, he deletes as well. It's not surprising, I guess, on the basis of this, that Tertullian, in one of his works against heresy, suggests that Marcion interpreted the New Testament with, quote, a penknife. In other words, just slice out what you don't like. Kind of reminds me, several years ago, in fact, on our honeymoon, my wife and I stopped in Charlottesville, Virginia, and visited Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Well, there was a New Testament on display there, Thomas Jefferson's version of the New Testament. He had actually gone through with a knife and cut out the miracles, because he didn't believe in miracles. He liked the teachings and ethics of Jesus. He didn't like the miracles, so just cut them out. What's the problem when, you know, if you've got something printed on two sides of the page, you cut out the miracle on one side, you perhaps cut something else out on the back side. But that's kind of the mentality that Marcion was using. In another writing, Tertullian refers to what he calls the Pontic mouse. Pontic is a takeoff on Pontus, where he was from. The Pontic mouse who has gnawed the gospel to pieces. So you go from an image of a knife to an image of, you know, this little rodent there chewing away at the scriptures and eating the parts that he doesn't want in there. So this perhaps was one of the more radical elements of Marcion, but obviously it's rooted in his conviction that the God of the Old Testament is an evil God. A seventh teaching of Marcion relates more to lifestyle issues. How do we live the Christian life, if indeed that's the kind of life he's trying to live? Marcion was very ascetic. Asceticism is kind of disciplining the body for spiritual purposes. And there's been a lot of asceticism in the history of the church, and some ascetics have been more extreme than others. I mean, some ascetics actually have beaten themselves and kind of abused their bodies thinking that this would have a spiritual benefit. Well, Marcion didn't beat himself, but he did urge ascetic practices on his followers. For example, celibacy. The ideal was not to marry, not to engage in sexual relations. When they celebrated the Lord's Supper in the Marcionite movement, which apparently they did, they replaced wine with water. Now, in Southern Baptist life, you know, most of us use grape juice, but at least it's the same color as wine, and it comes from the same fruit. Once you put water there, I don't know, how do you, of course, you know, I guess Marcion would have a hard time with the idea that Jesus had blood to begin with, so maybe that played into this as well as the asceticism. There were ascetic attitudes towards certain foods. It was forbidden in the Marcionite movement to eat meat or drink milk or have dairy products. The reason was because of their association with sexual reproduction. Of course, when you get down to it, I don't know, there's not too many foods you could probably eat that didn't have some kind of link to reproduction in some form or another. One of the odd things was that the Marcionites were allowed to eat fish. But, I mean, fish reproduce, right? Don't they lay eggs? Or I don't know if they... I don't know the biology of fish too well, but, I mean, I know they have eggs. And
what about fruit?
Fruit has seeds.
Purposes.
Yeah. And you plant the seeds, you're going to get more fruit, or fruit trees, or whatever. Well, he perhaps was not fully consistent. Now, you could get into the movement if you were married. The problem is that you were a second-class member of the movement if you were married, because only the unmarried were allowed to be baptized in Marcionite churches. About the only way you could be baptized if you were married is at the end of life. I guess if you were dying and they figured, well, you know, we'll just go ahead and baptize you. But baptism was normally reserved for the unmarried. So obviously two classes of members in Marcionite churches. The final point that I'll make here about his teaching, actually based again on Ferguson's summary, is that the followers of Jesus are not under the law in any way. Salvation is by grace alone, which, of course, many Christians would affirm that. The problem is that Marcion takes it to an extreme, and he doesn't see any use for the law. And to illustrate how that would differ from, say, the Protestant reformers, who were very strong on salvation by grace through faith, John Calvin, for example, argued that the law could become or could be, function as a guide for Christians in living the Christian life. It was not a means of salvation, to be sure, but it could provide guidelines for actually working out the Christian life. Marcion would have had none of that. grace for him, he felt, needs no law. And it's interesting, probably his favorite letter of Paul was Galatians. And yet, I don't think he fully comprehends some of the things that Paul is saying there, particularly in terms of Old Testament backgrounds. You know, Paul does refer to the law as a schoolmaster, which you would think would have some positive connotations. I mean, once you're done school, you don't turn around and just repudiate your teachers. At least I hope you don't. And clearly what Paul is suggesting there is that the law actually helps to prepare the way for Christ. So it's not totally contrary to grace. There is some continuity between law and grace. It's just that Marcion didn't want to admit that. And I came across an interesting statement by N.T. Wright. Wright he's actually a bishop in the Church of England and quite a New Testament scholar. Excellent book, for example, on the resurrection. It would take you a while to get through it because it's several hundred pages in length. But N.T. Wright has another book called The New Testament and the People of God, in which he actually alludes to Marcion in a very critical way, feeling that Marcion has basically distorted Paul. He puts it this way. This is Wright. He says, Paul's fundamental narrative continues to resonate with the story of Israel, because Israel's story speaks of a creator God who claims all people, all lands as his own. Paul is able to reach out from within that story and address Jews and Gentiles. He thus claims that the story of Jesus fulfills the purpose for which the creator called Abraham in the first place. And in fact, Abraham is very prominent in Galatians 3. That kind of continuity between the story of Israel and what has been revealed in Jesus Christ, that just goes over Marcion's head. He'll have none of that. So what you have with Marcion then is this radical discontinuity between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, and I think indeed a major error. And the church fathers were justified in seeing him as a heretic. Now, we may question whether the church fathers maybe went a little overboard in their descriptions of him and in some of the language they use. I have another quote here from Tertullian where this is in against Marcion, and he's addressing the Marcionites, and he says, "Now then, you dogs, whom the apostle puts aside, and who yelp at the God of truth, let us come to your various questions. These are the bones of contention which you are perpetually gnawing." So here, you know, he has the image of the penknife, he has the image of the mouse, and now it's a dog. Of course, Paul called the circumcisers dogs in Philippians chapter 3. So maybe Tertullian was thinking, well, if Paul can call them dogs, I can call them dogs. But I think certainly what these church fathers sensed was that there's something deeply flawed in the teachings of Marcion. So with that in mind, what was the response of those who considered themselves Orthodox over against Marcion? Well, I think one could argue that some of the early Christian creeds probably had Marcion in mind as sort of a counterpoint. You know, most of us are familiar with the Apostles' Creed. It's probably the oldest Christian creed that's still used in many churches today. But if you examine some of the statements in the Apostles' Creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. See, Marcion would have said that's the evil God, and he would not have wanted that in a Christian creed. And in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary. No, Marcion would have had none of that. There's a reference in the Apostles' Creed to Jesus coming to judge the quick and the dead. Again, Marcion wouldn't have bought that either. So it's possible that as the Apostles' Creed was being put together, that the heresies of Marcion were, at least in, you know, among other heresies, in view here to say, you know, we don't accept those views. This is what we affirm about God the Creator, about Jesus being born, etc. Also, of course, Marcion's attempt to define the New Testament probably stimulated the church to do more serious thinking about, well, what really belongs in the canon. Of course, once the apostles died, you really want to preserve the apostolic witness. And so the canon question becomes more urgent when you have heretics coming up with a very short canon. Marcion, I think, he would not have wanted to do this, but he ends up, I think, bringing among the Orthodox a deeper appreciation of the Jewish roots of the faith, of the continuity of the Old and New Testament, the oneness of God, the goodness of creation, the whole idea that Christianity was not a separate revelation, but it was a fulfillment of something that was already there, in a, at least in a seed form, in an older time. What we also find in the second century, I think partly in response to Marcion, is an emphasis on what's called the rule of faith. Several of the church fathers refer to what they call the rule of faith. This was a consensus of belief that most Christians affirmed. Obviously, there were exceptions like the Marcionites and the Gnostics. But this rule of faith may well have been background to documents like the Apostles' Creed. In other words, that the creeds existed in this kind of consensus of belief that was there for some time. And the church fathers were convinced that this rule of faith went back to the apostles, that the apostles had passed on the truth of the gospel, and that it was summarized in this rule of faith, and that this went over against what the heretics were teaching. And I think probably one could also say that Marcion's ideas probably also caused the church fathers to address more seriously the problem of evil. Because Marcion's answer was, well, evil comes from the evil creator. And obviously that wasn't very satisfying to the Orthodox within the church. So Marcion has, kind of ripples that affect the church as they react to him and attempt to articulate Orthodox views over against what he was teaching. Now, one of the questions that, I guess we're basically out of time here. Let me just kind of wrap this up. What's the relevance of all this? I mean, why look at a second century heretic like Marcion? There are no Marcionite churches today, at least by that name. Well, I think perhaps what studying Marcionism may suggest to us is that it may be a warning against the kind of practical Marcionism. I mean, Marcion just threw out the Old Testament. And I'm wondering if there is a danger today of people simply ignoring it. They don't reject it outright, but they just don't pay much attention to it. So you can end up in a kind of practical Marcionism. And there's also, I think, a tendency in some people's minds to sort of, you know, bring in discontinuities like, well, you know, in the Old Testament, God's a judge. In the New Testament, you know, God's a loving father. And in reality, that's a false dichotomy. I've been recently read this book. I actually saw it over there on one of the tables. Stephen Keeler is actually Garrison Keeler's brother. Stephen Keeler, though, is a very committed Christian and a historian. He's done this book called God's Judgments. I mean, he believes that God continues to judge as he always has, and that, you know, there are events even in U.S. history that may represent the judgment of God. And in that context, he attacks those who say that this idea of God as judge is just an Old Testament thing. And Keeler argues, no, it's more than just an Old Testament thing. And, you know, ultimately, I teach both Old and New Testament survey here at Union to undergraduates. And as I teach those classes, I'm more and more impressed with how they interrelate so much. You know, surely there is judgment in the Old Testament. But it's interesting that when there is judgment, there is often grace at the same time. I mean, the world was judged and Noah was saved. Sodom and Gomorrah was judged, Lot was saved. There are promises about a remnant that will be preserved even when Israel is judged. And then you have a book like Hosea, which, I mean, Hosea is a prophet, and yet one of the major pictures there is Hosea redeeming his unfaithful wife. You know, expressing a love toward her that she apparently did not deserve. And that becomes a picture of God extending his love and redemptive grace to unfaithful Israel. So there's elements of both in the Old Testament and likewise in the New Testament. I mean, obviously there are passages about, you know, God as a loving God and as a loving Father, but there's also tones of judgment in the New Testament. Jesus himself presents words of judgment. Matthew 24, Matthew 25, Book of Revelation. So it's a lot more complex than people who want to say, well, you know, judging God in the Old Testament, loving God in the New Testament. That it really ends up distorting and breaking down the very important continuities that we have between the Testaments. Anyone want to ask a quick question or make a comment? I think lunch is about 12:15. We can take a couple minutes. We've run over a little bit, but... Any comments or questions here?
What made him take on this ideology? I mean, he said he was raised a Christian.
Yeah, his father, from all we can tell, his father was not a heretic. So, you know, whether he was outright rebelling against what his father taught, it's hard to tell. Unfortunately, we just do not have accurate historical picture of him as, say, as a child and as a young man. It's interesting, that question came up at the 8:30 session as well. You know, what were his sources? Were there other people who taught these things? Well, it's hard to find in the history of Christianity anybody before Marcion who put things that radically. We do know that there were dualistic worldviews around, for example, from Persia. Zoroastrianism is very dualistic. What we don't know is whether Marcion had contacts with Zoroastrians.
Platonists, or he wouldn't have had the demiurge notion there.
Yeah.
That's pretty easy because Platonists were everywhere anyway.
Yeah. Right. So it's a very good question. It's one that's very hard to answer. Because our sources, we just don't have a full biography of Marcion. You know, we have snippets in many of the church fathers, but nothing like a complete story. So,
was he a big headache to them?
Pardon?
Was he a big headache to the church fathers?
Well, they make him out that way, which, you know, again, it may mean that the movement was a fairly sizable movement for them to address the issues the way they do.
There
were people who identified themselves with the Christian movement who ended up as Marcionites. Whether they were genuine believers, of course, would be another question, because it might suggest that if they were believers, they were rather immature and did not have a grasp of things, and thus they were misled. But again, we would like to have more records. We don't really have accounts of individuals, say, other than Marcion himself, who ended up in this movement.
I don't know if it's still in print, but when I was in seminary, there was a book by von Harnack.
Yes. Yeah, and von Harnack actually seems a bit sympathetic toward Marcion, but. Of course, von Harnack also believed that, he believed that I think it wasn't one of his theses that Paul had sort of distorted Jesus. So that wouldn't exactly fit with Marcion. But I think one of the things von Harnack was trying to do was to sort of suggest that Marcion was a very primitive representative of the Protestant principle. And I don't think that that's a good way to interpret Marcion.